Hello, everyone. It is, your good friend in Little Saigon again, Dan. And I think technically this will be my first podcast of 2019 for the Little Saigon Report, which I don't know, half a dozen people probably listen to. Most people who get sucked into its vortex get pissed off and go away. And I gotta say, that's probably okay. As long as I keep it real. Which to the point becomes the topic. That's what it is, keeping it real. So, yes, it is Wednesday, excuse me, January the 2nd, 2019, in this very strange year, filled with all sorts of deception. I mean, if I could give advice at the beginning of the year to people, I'm not going to ask you to be as paranoid as me. You don't have to be. You don't have to be that paranoid, but. You could at least be a little paranoid, just a little bit wondering if you're being deceived. Because I think there's a lot of deception out there. So I want to jump into the main topic, but before I do, I have to explain I'm a little bit both in a good place and a bad place. I got some help from a friend yesterday. Really welcome help. I'm kind of a prideful person. God knows this, literally. Like, God knows that I shouldn't be so prideful, but sometimes I'm prideful to the point of being self-destructive. But I asked for help, and I got some help, and so, it was really cool. And in the process of getting help, I accidentally did something. Now this was an accident. This was not planned. There was no malice of forethought or anything like that. It was just one of those really kooky accidents. I ended up going someplace with my friend. I drove, had the keys in my pocket when I got back. My friend got a Uber for me. And I had the keys in my pocket still, and they were important keys because my friend's husband had to go to work later. And so the whole thing was a fiasco. Now, I'd like to say all's well that ends well, but the fiasco really didn't end until midnight plus 30 minutes. And it was that point that my friend showed up with her husband for the keys because he has to work late, and those are critical keys. None of this was planned, none of this was on purpose. But when you get help from somebody, and then all of a sudden, the first thing that happens is a fiasco, and I can't really call anything else but a fiasco. It's really depressing. It is depressing, and yet still I got some help, and the whole thing is a fiasco. And I don't know. I mean, clearly I should have checked my pockets, so I did make a mistake. And there's this part of me that wants to blame the French bulldog. Like, essentially, they have a French bulldog. I think it may be kind of possessed by a demon. Although, if you own a French bulldog or know somebody that owns a French bulldog, you may have wondered at times if there's some type of a demon beast or creature that's living inside of your French bulldog. But there's part of me because, I recently read the book, The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. There's this, I just wonder, what if. This particular French bulldog, which speaks like this, that's actual French bulldog speak. Yes, they'll bark, but their main language sounds like this. And if you don't have a French bulldog and you've never heard it talk like that, okay. But once you have, you'll realize something about the French bulldog. And here's the thing, I am an anarchist and I am basically a pacifist. I'm not someone who says, don't own a gun. I'm not against self-defense. In fact, I believe in the non-aggression principle, which means you don't have a right to organize, bullies to go beat people up, voluntarily or not. Whether people volunteer to be bullies or not, you don't really have a right to organize these people with guns and bombs and just murder people. I just believe that's true. But I also believe that if bullies are coming to your door, you have a right to defend yourself. I see no contradiction. If you do, I am sorry. Anyways, that's a bit off topic. But yeah, this French bulldog. If I were evil and worked for the CIA, I think I would basically at Guantanamo have a whole field of containers, metal containers. Inside is a French bulldog. Of course, you got to give it the right temperature so it can be okay. And then you'll simply feed it cat food because French bulldogs love cat food. And you'll just let the French bulldog live inside the container. But every once in a while, you'll put it in a little cage so it'll start bleeding. And then, the prisoner in the container with the French bulldog can listen to that for like, I don't know, 6 hours. Or just record the bleeding of a French bulldog. I have some MP3s and recordings. I don't think I have them set for free download off of SoundCloud, but I have an MP3 with a recording you could hijack of a French bulldog. I think it's like one of my little Saigon reports from a month ago. Could have been 14, number 14, but there's one. Yeah. It's horrible. Would you want to hear that for 16 hours? Mm-mm. So, anyways, I'm kind of convinced that French bulldogs are vessels for demons. That doesn't mean all French bulldogs contain demons. It also does not imply that the particular French bulldog in question is possessed by a demon. But one theory for what happened last night with the whole situation with the keys and the fiasco is that their French bulldog is possessed by a demon named Ringo Dingo. I know that's scary. And if you say Ringo Dingo three times, if you say you should not, don't ever go in the don't go in the bathroom, don't look in the mirror. Don't look in the mirror, don't go in the bathroom late on a Saturday night. I know there's a bunch of teenagers, well, excuse me, nobody listens to me. But if there were an underage person who shouldn't be listening to this podcast, it's for adults, but if there were a teenager hearing this, I have no doubt they'll go and they'll say, "We need to go and do this in a mirror." But no. On a Friday night at the scary hour, sometime between 11:15 and 11:45 p.m., go to your bathroom upstairs and turn off the lights in the bathroom with a big mirror and close the door and only have one candle lit. And then stare into the mirror and say Ringo Dingo three times. Now, I'm not telling you Ringo Dingo will show up. And I'm also, as a Christian, saying you should not do this because I think it is against biblical commandments. You shouldn't do this. So yeah, don't do it. But if you did it, a French bulldog, my friend's French bulldog, would show up and probably fart in your face. And I will tell you this, you'll never want to experience that again. Ever. So yeah, I wasn't really going to do this one about the fiasco, but I talked about it. Really, the purpose of this, which is kind of related, and it is keeping it real, is the question of reality. Now, I've talked a lot about reality because I think I get obsessed with it. Some of my questions about reality, what composes the thing we call the world, led me down the road to God. Like, essentially, I was an atheist most of my life. Even when I was a kid in kindergarten with Sister Marjorie, excuse me, Margarine. If you're old enough, you know what Margarine is. And Sister Marjorie, when I was in kindergarten, I would call her Sister Margarine. But the point is, Sister Margarine, even back then, I think I just didn't really believe. I saw it as basically special effects. Like after, I think I was 7 or 8 when I saw Star Wars, episode 4, whatever, A New Hope, blah, blah, blah. The original Star Wars. I was probably maybe 7 years old or 8 years old. And I think it was one of those first moments I kind of realized that they could really fake a lot of crap because imagination will fill in the blanks. Here's the thing about old sci-fi movies, like, for example, Forbidden Planet or Them, the one about the giant ants. Even though the special effects is kind of, backward by comparison to what they can do today, your imagination would fill in the blanks. It's why the, original video games, Atari games, were cool and fun. They were cool and fun, not because they were super advanced, but because they didn't have to solve the whole problem. Like the whole problem for playing the video game wasn't about the game as much as the game was a focus of imagination. So, that's the thing about it, is that imagination will fill in a lot of blanks. I think it explains a lot of phenomena like UFOs. People will see a strange thing, not really know what it is, and then apply a little bit of imagination, and all of a sudden you have a UFO. Or if it's the late 19th century, and this is a real thing, you have an airship scare. Like back in the late 19th century, a bunch of people were looking up in the sky and thinking they were seeing airships. Now, I think Jules Verne had written a novel, a sci-fi novel, about, you know, a guy called the Master of the World or something who had a super giant airship. I'm not a Jules Verne expert, so if I got this wrong, I apologize. But I believe Jules Verne wrote a story about this. So it's possible that this is a good example of an early meme, that Jules Verne writing about some scary guy in an airship that goes around the world, you know, practicing his own special kind of vigilante justice from above, perhaps that did infect enough people in terms of the common way that stories work. Because here's the thing about people who read books. People who read books will often talk to people about the book. So the story gets retold, maybe not perfectly, but that actually works to the benefit of these crazy memes. They don't. They need to tell the core themes, right? There's a scary guy in an airship. So yeah, back in the late 19th century, you might have looked up in the sky, and because of your culture, because of the technology of the age, because of what people were saying was just on the horizon, especially if it was lighter than aircraft, because this, you know, there's still, the Wright brothers wasn't even a thing yet, so there still was no airplane. It was just balloons, basically, and some fairly primitive, you know, blimps and not really dirigibles, but things that were primitive, that primitive lighter than aircraft that were controllable, not just balloons. And so the late 19th century, there was that weird scare. So I bring this up because that's the thing. Imagination will fill in a lot of blanks when it comes to the coarseness of anything, including reality itself. So pretty much my whole life, I've been interested in this topic. Before I was ever introduced to any philosophy or even anything approaching what we would call science, you know, full disclosure, most of my academic background is in the liberal arts, history, to some extent philosophy, though most of that self-studied philosophy. And most of that happened in my 20s. In my 40s, which I'm almost out of now, I've mostly been reading crap online and fiction. I've kind of eschewed anything that you would call nonfiction, mostly and primarily because in my own mind, a lot of nonfiction is looking like fiction to me. So it's a question of if I'm going to be reading fiction, whether it's the New York Times or Lovecraft, I'd rather be reading Lovecraft because the stories aren't as horrible and the writing's better. So yeah, I would choose Lovecraft over the New York Times. Both are horrible. Both are probably demonic. But Lovecraft's writing is better. So reality is this thing. And the thing about reality is it is a semantically problematic word. It's a lot like the word gravity. You know, and I've actually seen interviews of folks like Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I am not going to get into all the flat earth crap because I just don't want to talk about that. That's a whole nother topic. But I do find it interesting that when someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson gets cornered on what is gravity, he starts spinning into this weird yarn. It's almost like he's telling a tale. And that's the thing. Words like gravity are a lot like words like reality. And I would also say to some extent, words like faith or God. These are hard words to define. Free will, believe it or not, for me is an easier to define concept than God. I believe in God. I feel I know what God is, but if you ask me to define in one paragraph what is God, I'm not sure I would do that because I would say, well, you could say then, well, he's the master of the universe, but isn't that just circular? So yeah, there are these words that are so abundant with meaning that it's difficult to define them. It doesn't mean they're meaningless. It's actually the opposite. It's kind of just that there's too much meaning there. Gravity is kind of one of those words. It gets used a lot. And there are some physicists, you know, I think Michio Kaku would say he's one of those people who believe they can define things like gravity. But the point is, gravity is one of those things where if you ask a physicist what is gravity, they'll spin a tale. And it doesn't mean they're lying. It just means it's not easy to define something like that. In many ways, you're defining a quality which itself is really not a very good definition, a feature, almost an after effect. But the after effect is like a vapor, it just goes away. So it is hard. It's like time. ask a physicist to define time for you. Now, he might do a whole song and dance about space, time, and Einstein, but to me, that sounds like a musical. Actually, that's another musical. After I compose Marauds, which will be the anarchist feat, then I need to do Einstein and space-time, because that's the thing. They'll do the space-time dance, and they'll do it, and they'll say, okay, this and that, and you'll say, okay, that's what time is. So reality, which is worse than all these words, because if you were thinking this from a if you were thinking about this from a physicist's perspective, the word reality has way more to do with what they're doing at CERN and things like the Higgs boson and grand unification theory than anything else. Like from a science perspective, the word reality is related, in my opinion, to something called cosmology. It is the question of what is the nature of the universe. And physicists ask these questions. I don't know if they ask the right questions or if they're getting the right answers, but they ask these questions. What is the nature of reality? And for many physicists today, the nature is in some type of solution to the general theories involving things like particle physics, for example. And how is particle physics related to relativity? Essentially, a grand unification theory can join Einstein and Newton and Heisenberg and quantum mechanics and all these things kind of together in some perfect dance where everything makes sense. And there are some logicians who would argue that, and I believe it's Gödel's incompleteness theorems, but there are some philosophers slash logicians who would argue that the whole venture is doomed from the beginning, that there's never going to be a general theory of everything. I don't want to get into that too much, because to me, the problem with that is you've already gone down the road too far. It's true of anything that involves language, and that's kind of our initial trap. It's why, even though I have certain beliefs that seem out of place in terms of what I've been exposed to, it's one of the reasons why I don't totally poo-poo Jacques Derrida's work or deconstruction, because you can't completely poo-poo it. You know, sure, there's a lot of ridiculous features to deconstruction as a general philosophy of language, but one of the things you have to respect is this notion of the general play and how much respect, I believe, how much fundamental respect that Derrida pays to the abundant kind of meaning of things by their very nature. That words have more than one meaning is almost trivial. That I think is valuable. So when we think about the word reality, we have to think of it in those terms also. It's almost like we have to ask, what is reality not as well? Like, what if reality is a thing, what is fake reality? What is illusion? Because that's the other thing too. Ask someone to explain what an illusion is. Now, one of the ways of explaining it, you know, would be to say, well, Dan, an illusion is like a trick. It's like a mirage. And keep in mind, that's how the dance begins. They'll say it's like this, it's like this. Okay, so an illusion is like a mirage. But a mirage is an actual real thing. Yeah, it gets misinterpreted as something else, but mirages are not magical. They are real features of the universe. So when someone says that, well, it's a mirage, that's like an illusion, that's what an illusion is. Well, no, mirages are real things. So what is an illusion? If it's hard to define what reality is, I hate to break it to you, it's hard to define what an illusion is. Because the problem is once you go down this road, you have to start accepting certain possibilities. You know, like, for example, and again, this isn't original, FYI, this whole rant or podcast about reality. If you notice other philosophers entering into my speech without me referencing them, I apologize. But if you read a lot, you get exposed to a lot. And there was a time I dove deeply into the waters of philosophy. I can't say it's recent. Recently, I've been mostly, when I do read books, I read things like the Bible or Lovecraft or Bukowski or something along those lines. I religiously read James Howard Kunstler's blog because it just seems like the right thing to do, and it's also enjoyable. But there was a time when I dove deeply into philosophy. So if you notice some ideas in my speech, but I'm not properly citing the source, I apologize, but that's the nature of learning, and hopefully these concepts are things that are considered resilient through time. But for the most part, I'm trying to see the world as a free-range human being, a hobo philosopher, so buy it as you will. getting back to the main topic, reality is a problematic word. Illusion is a problematic word. But if you ask yourself, what is an illusion? Then you are asking yourself if such a thing exists. Because like for me, I don't think illusions actually exist in the real sense. Like they're just a misinterpretation. I remember this one Christmas party I went to, and I really pissed off the people at my table. We were all on separate tables having dinner, and they had these magicians go around to the different tables and do card tricks. And tricks, you know, and the whole three card Monty and where's the ball and stuff like that. And the first rule I learned a long time ago is keep your eyes on the hands. Like if you want to focus on the eyes or the face, he's going to trick you, in all likelihood he already tricked you, or she, but whoever the magician might be. But if you watch the hands of a magician and you're just discerning enough, you're never really going to be tricked. I really pissed the people off at the table. I kept my eyes on the hands. I didn't listen to his crap. When he tried to make a joke, I went, "Huh," you know? And he kind of got pissed off in a way too. He kept his sense of humor. He had a good sense of humor about it, but he got a little irritated about the whole thing. So for me, there was no real illusion, okay? It was a matter of simply interpreting reality correctly. So for me, that's a separate topic. Like if you want to talk about, do people get tricked? Yeah, people get tricked. I've been tricked many times in my life. That does not imply that reality itself flipped between a state of true and false. Like at one point it was true and the other moment it was false. It just means I wasn't seeing things correctly. I got tricked. I got bamboozled. People get bamboozled. Sometimes they even trick themselves. You know, dogs enjoy chasing their tails. Everybody, you know, loves a little bit of imagination. And if you think about the dog chasing its tail and a little bit of imagination, all of a sudden, you can see how people can trick themselves. So what is reality? If it's hard to define something like gravity, how hard must it be to define reality? Like, let's say, for example, all this Higgs boson research leads some cosmologists to determine that he or she can figure out the nature of reality. And then some really ignorant person stands up and raises their hand and says, okay, but what was before that? And then the scientist sits there for a second, or it could be an AI. I mean, imagine 100 years in the future, a supercomputer. And I'm not trying to rip off, you know, Douglas Adams here. I'm not trying to rip off Hitchhiker's Guide. I'm not going to call it deep thought. IBM already ripped that name off. No, imagine a giant supercomputer 100 years from now. Let's call him, you know, Fergus, in honor of a dog that somebody once lost. The supercomputer Fergus is sitting somewhere in Scotland, and someone asks for, and Fergus says, I've figured it out, and he's saying it with a Scottish accent. I figured it out. I know how everything started and the nature of reality. And then some human or android or synthetic mix or some other horrible demon raises their hand and says, okay, sir, but what was there before that? And then even worse than that, the same dude asks a follow-on question, what's outside of it? And then he keeps going. He says, well, what would it be if it wasn't what it was? Like, what would be the opposite of it? You know, if that is being, what is nothingness? This is kind of the trail you end up going down. So even if you're a hardcore materialist, and you might be, you still have to ask a lot of questions. In fact, it's incumbent upon you. And we haven't even delved too deeply into the really the more physiological aspects of the psychology. The fact is, all of these conversations, all of these experiences, all of these realities are being processed by a chunk of wet matter we call the brain. Now, I'm religious, so I think humans have a soul. But the soul is not the brain. That's just my opinion. And the brain is not the soul. So what the brain is to me, though, it is probably a truly complicated computer. And Penrose might be right. It could be a quantum computer. So you have this incredibly powerful machine called the brain, right? And that machine is where, quote-unquote, reality is being rendered. Reality is not being rendered outside. Reality is being rendered inside of that chunk of fat you call the brain. So if you ask yourself, what is reality? It almost seems like the only intelligent answer, if you believe that the brain is the seat of consciousness, yeah, it's the reality is the brain. The brain is reality. It sounds horrible in a way because it almost seems like if you took two stories by Lovecraft, The Outsider and The Whisperers in the Darkness, and you fused them together, you said to yourself, you're in this terrible situation where you're horrified because everybody, is having their brains put into jars or into metal canisters. And I'm being fast and loose with Whispers in the Darkness right now, but I'm just trying to play with the ideas. But the general theme. So take the general themes of Whispers in the Darkness, general themes of The Outsider, and you're in this world and you see that people are putting their brains, or you notice that people are really just brains in metal canisters. But then you come to the realization that you're just a brain inside of a calcium canister, really, a bone canister. Yeah, sorry, you're actually a brain floating inside of a little aquarium that is surrounded by a bone case. Your brain floats in water. Now, well, not water, it's really cerebral spinal fluid, but you get my point. Your brain sits inside of a cavity that is a fluid cavity. It gets worse because you think about people who do these whole, for example, down the street on 12th Street, there is a company that has like isolation chambers. I assume it's like that movie with, I think it was it William Hurt or something, or but that movie, Altered States, where he would go into the isolation chamber with the saline. And they actually did a kind of homage to this in Stranger Things season one, where they put the young girl, 11 or whatever her name was, 11, they put her into a solution in an isolation chamber, well, more like inside of the basketball gym area, the gym with lights off in solution. The point is, there are people who do this. They go into isolation chambers. You can pay to do this. But really, it's weird and recursive because your brain is already doing this. Your brain is sitting inside of an isolation chamber. And its only connection to reality, its only connection, is a chunk of nerve endings that go out of the brain down, essentially through the reptilian brain, all the way down through the brain stem and outward, And there are some nerves that, connect closer to the eyes and the ears. But the point is, the brain itself is not directly connected. So it is indirectly connected through a giant bus structure, a giant, connection point, but it is really just a connection. So you think about it, if you disconnected that part of the connection, you don't need an isolation chamber. You're already in one. And this is really spooky because I feel like I've given the CIA too many ideas so far. I told them about the French Bulldog. Here's the other thing. If you could use EMF or electromagnetic force to actually block signals, without killing someone from their sources of, auditory, sensory, all those things, block their senses, you're already in an isolation chamber. Your brain's already floating. So essentially, yeah, it would be weird, but you could induce the same effect. But also, it doesn't sound very Christian. Keep that in mind. So don't do it. Don't mess with French bulldogs. Don't do Ringo Dingo. Don't use like some type of, super MRI to shut down people's access to reality, because that's probably a terrible thing to do. Plus, their third eye will probably point someplace scary, like maybe hell. So please, please, please never do something like this ever. Also, isolation chambers could be dangerous. I guess I feel like I want to create a scale of things you probably shouldn't do called the Ouija board scale. But the point is, there are things you probably shouldn't do as a Christian because they run the risk of summoning demons. I know that sounds crazy. I know I sound crazy. I, for example, have done mushrooms once in a while. I'll admit to this. Not proud, not ashamed. I believe they grow in the ground. I think the, God created the earth. The devil didn't create mushrooms. He didn't create anything on earth. So I don't think God created them as a sin or as a temptation. I think they're in the earth. I also think they're probably a sacred thing. So yeah, that's a good reason to not just go do them. But doing mushrooms, I think, can open up access to places that I think are probably evil. You've got to be careful. If you're going to do a mushroom, you better take your Christianity with you into whatever universe you're going into, because ultimately that other place is most likely not a good place. Probably doing mushrooms is a dangerous thing to do. So on the Ouija board scale, there are these things. Don't do Ringo Dingo. Don't do isolation chambers. Probably shrooms are dangerous, but I'm not going to tell you not to do them because that would be hypocrisy. But yeah, so that's the thing about reality, is that if you break it down, it's hard to define. It is the biggest thing. You know, Descartes and his Meditations begins with this possible supposition that maybe there's some demon fooling everyone, that reality, the world he experiences, is really just some kind of spell or curse. It's not a real thing. I'm paraphrasing a bit, but that's his view. That's where he starts. He is that critical, a thinker, when he starts, that Descartes proposes that maybe reality is an illusion being generated either by something or someone to deceive. And you know, truly, there in first and second century aberrant, you know, sort of Christian offshoot religions, which again, I don't support, but there were offshoots like Gnosticism that were kind of pseudo-Christian, but not really. But the Gnostics kind of had the similar view of things. And, you know, actually, I think a traditional Christian could say the following. God rules the universe, but in many ways, the devil walks the earth. And the devil, said this before, I'll say it again, the devil is the greatest liar that ever lived. So great liars know how to create tricks. So yeah, do I think the devil could create a reality that would seem like reality, even if you're not dead, you're not in hell, but you're just on earth? Yeah. I think if you read the book of Job, there's a bit of that going on. You know, God basically says, hey, okay, do your worst. And the devil does his worst. And that's the thing. The devil doesn't have to do that many things. He doesn't have to take that many actions to undo whatever we think reality is and replace it with something, you know, different and probably worse. I think we're living through it. You know, I think this is the day and age. We're living in an age where almost as a religion, we're being preached this notion of alternate realities. For example, that Krauss guy, I'm not an expert on Krauss, you know, the physicist, but he is one of these spokespeople for multiverse theory. And I have to say, I have dabbled both in my fiction and in my philosophy with notions of the multiverse. I can accept the following statement, that in my current way of looking at the world, both philosophically, religiously, and otherwise, that you can interpret superposition and certain concepts of quantum physics in certain kinds of ways that are specifically scientific, and therefore separate from some of these pop philosophical metaphysical schemes. Heisenberg uncertainty principle, for example, doesn't prove free will. I mean, people say, well, it proves free will. No, it doesn't. What it says is that there are limits to our ability to observe the universe. Well, gee, you don't need a super collider to know that. You should already kind of know that. There are limits to what you can know about the world. And when it gets to very small scales, the walls are so thick that all you can do are really just make guesses, which means you're playing with probability. That is the long and the short of much of quantum mechanics. It is very much about likelihoods, because when you're at that scale, all you can really do are make good guesses. I believe this particle will be in this position, but it could be in the other position. Now, that's the point, though. Once you observe the event, it is locked in. It is like Schrodinger's cat. Listen, when the door or the trap door of the Schrodinger's cat box is closed, the cat is either alive or dead. Now, of course, you're a cruel, cruel, jerky physicist, probably a terrible Danish evil physicist. So you have all kinds of these boxes with cats inside of them, with little poisonous bottles. So you close the door, the poisonous gas gets released, the cat is dead. But the point is, the door is closed. So as long as the door is closed, you don't really know that the cat is dead. You know that the bottle of poison broke. You know that there's 100% certainty that if the cat breathes the poison, the cat will be dead, right? But you don't really know for sure. That is the thought experiment around Schrödinger's cat, and I think it's a solid thought experiment, but it applies to many, many things. You could contend that the Schrödinger's cat problem applies to most of reality. You know, there are many cases where it's hard to get final verification. It really is. For example, when it comes to mass delusion or mass opinion, it is the opinion of a lot of Americans that we went to the moon back in the 1960s and 1970s, that we went there, we orbited with humans, we landed on the moon, we came back. I, for one, no longer believe that story. I'm not saying they totally lied. I just don't know what the truth is. What I can tell you, from my perspective, it is implausible that you do something like that and forget how to do it. It is implausible that you do something like that, and then you have a NASA spokesman many, many years later say, we have to figure out how to get through the Van Allen belts to get to the moon. This is implausible stuff. This is ridiculous. You don't lose all of those tapes. You don't lose the ability to read certain tapes. You don't lose documents. You don't say, well, all of our contractors burned the designs. How the hell do people do something that's quote unquote that amazing technologically and then just set fire to the designs? And how does anybody buy that? And on top of it, if that were true, like assume for the sake of argument, we went to the moon, we did this spectacular, amazing thing, and then we basically dynamited the whole thing. Why would you ever give the government another fucking penny? Are you stupid? The only plausible thing you're left with, if you want to stick with the main story, is that they are incredibly fucking incompetent on a monumental scale. You should never give them another fucking dime. Because NASA is the thing people, you know, most statists, people who believe in government, are proud of NASA. Well, okay, so why did we forget how we went to the moon? So there are many things in reality that might be true, but like the dead cat in Schrödinger's box, you won't know until you open the door. And the problem is there are many doors that just can't be opened. I don't have the resources as one person to achieve final verification of whether we went to the moon. I don't have the resources as one person to even verify if we can actually travel in space. Truly, I don't have the resources to verify if there is a space. I know that sounds wild and crazy. And no, I'm not admitting to believing in the flat Earth. But yes, it is the case. I literally can't verify on any level whatsoever that there is this thing called outer space. I don't have the resources. So, like the Schrödinger's cat experiment, the door for me is closed. Now, as a betting man, if I'm going to assign a probability, let's start someplace pedestrian. I've never been to Tahiti. I have never been to Tahiti. It looks really cool. If anybody who listens to my podcast, all three of you, have the resources to send me to Tahiti for a year as a research project in a nice condo on the beach, I think, and you know, obviously a stipend and shit. I think that'd be a great project. But anyways, I've never been to Tahiti. Never been there. Sounds awesome. I would wager that it's nearly certain that Tahiti exists because I can't believe people would lie about it on that scale. Never been there, taking everyone else's word for it. Tahiti probably exists. So I would say 99.99 with that little bar on the top, run on decimal. I think it is nearly certain that Tahiti exists. But I will say, because I respect reason and common sense, that I won't say 100% because I've never been there. I am very much a person, especially after the last few years of my life. I have become a person, you know, it's sort of like the Missouri motto, show me. I want you to show me. I want you to prove to me. If you want me to say with 100% certainty that there is a place called Tahiti, you're going to have to like fly me there and let me stay there for a year, you know, and pay for my beer and my food. And then, yes, I will sojourn in Tahiti and I will come to the realization it probably exists. But barring the exaggeration, that's kind of where I'm at. It is the thing with all of these cosmological experiments. They all suffer from the same basic defect that isn't really a defect, but it is the nature of reality. It isn't accidental that often the starting place and the ending place, and I've said this in other podcasts and I'll say it again. The start and the end, the alpha and omega of philosophy, is often solipsism. It's why Descartes and Plato, and frankly, every philosopher, really, worth any salt, has been obsessed with the question, how do I verify what is real? What is real? I mean, that's part of it, you know, substance and, you know, form and just talking about the nature of things, you know, or being like Edmund Husserl and just staring at his coffee cup all day. A big part of almost every philosophy, Eastern, Western, you name it, is about describing the nature of reality. And yet, any of those philosophers worth their salt, whether it's Descartes, whether it's Plato, whether it's Nietzsche, whether it's Jacques Derrida, the courageous philosophers will admit that it's very difficult to escape that basic trap. What if reality is just real for me? What if it's just the thing that surrounds me? I am a brain. I don't even know this with certainty, but if I'm to believe what I'm told, I'm a brain floating essentially in a cave made of a bone. And I have one connection with the world, basically. Yeah, it may have a couple offshoots, the two eyeballs and ears and whatnot, but I basically have one window, one doorway, one way out, one way, and really no way out, just one way in. That's the other thing, too. I can't get out, okay? If you think in purely in the biochemistry of the brain, we are all sort of trapped. You know, when people talk about syndromes of being trapped, these are real medical conditions and they're horrible. But on a certain level, we're all trapped. We are all assuming that what the information we're fed into our brain is real. It might not be. That's why it's the starting place and the ending place. And I have a lot more respect. You know, I don't... Plato's Republic is horrible to me. I'm an anarchist. Plato's Republic is a terrible book for the most part, but it has its moments. And you know, Plato was a brilliant philosopher. And the allegory of the cave is one of those redeeming moments of Plato's Republic. So, you know, I look at that in many ways as being the foundational example, at least in Western philosophy, of approaching this question. You know, and it's not original. Other people would say the same thing. The allegory of the cave. But the thing is that there is no real happy ending to that story. Like, think about the fact that the people in the cave end up rebuking the person that's seeing reality. The people remain trapped. You know, Plato can spin all the tales going on and how we can escape it through this weird society he wants to invent. This sounds quite horrible about throwing babies off cliffs. But what I'm telling you is that the undoing, the great value and the undoing of Plato's Republic is in the cave. It has always been in the cave. Your brain isn't. If you are a materialist, if you don't have any faith in God or whatever religion, but if you don't have any faith in God, or you're just strictly a materialist, period, there is truly no escape for you, because every phenomena you study, everything you say, well, this is what real is, it's still being tossed into the cave as a shadow play. And your brain, healthy, unhealthy, diseased or no, on drugs or not, well-fed or not fed enough, your brain is processing that shadow play, and then you're calling that reality. And that is the trap of materialism, but it's also the solipsist trap, and it is why solipsism is so attractive, because it's so consistent. You don't really have to say much at this point. I'm not saying, and that's the other thing about consistent philosophies, they do tend to be so simple, they're not just not that interesting, which I suppose could be good or bad, but the solipsist position is very consistent. You know, you do have to basically denounce every other human. You do have to basically say, I am the only real thing. And be careful, because a solipsist becomes a psychopath or sociopath very easily. But the solipsist position, thinking that the universe is just the universe for me, is attractive because it is consistent. On the other hand, if you have belief in a soul, for example, if you believe that consciousness is a bit more complicated than we currently realize. If, you know, I think that Penrose is right. I think the brain is a quantum computer. If your mind entertains other possibilities beyond just the biochemistry, then I would say there is an escape. It's just kind of complicated. And in some ways, like I said, potentially dangerous. Like, I will not, I mean, I was joking about this French bulldog, kind of, that it was all possessed. But, you know, you don't want to invoke demons, even if it's just a made-up demon called Ringo Dingo. At this point, people might already be writing horror stories about the French bulldog demon called Ringo Dingo. Yeah, don't do it. Don't say it three times in the mirror on a Friday night at 11:30, okay, with the lights out in the bathroom upstairs with a candle burning. Don't do it. Or down, any bathroom will do, but there has to be a candle. And the only light in the bathroom is a candle, and then you stare into the mirror and say Ringo Dingo three times. And then a French bulldog, a very flatulent French bulldog, appears and starts speaking to you like, and then, you know, yeah, and farts a lot, and it's terrible. He won't kill you, but you'll want to take a shower because that's how bad his farts are. And it truly is because of what it eats. It eats anything on the floor. Ringo Dingo. Oh my God. I am in trouble. I just invented a new kind of demon because of my experiences with French bulldogs. And I think on that note, this very long podcast should probably end. I think it's been too long. But yeah, I think you need to ponder this question of how you escape the trap. It isn't simply a biological trap. It is a kind of philosophical trap. And if you want to say, what is reality? If you want to convince people that it's some particle field theory or something else, you better explain to them, you know, how is it happening? Where is it happening? Because if you're left with the reality that it's happening in a chunk of, you know, fleshy matter called the brain, then I think the best you can say as a materialist is reality is the brain. The brain is reality, and holy crap, we're stuck back at solipsism. And with respect to, you know, these other issues of the occult and the supernatural, superstitious, or whatever you want to call it, because lots of words for things these days, and yet so many words are being told to go away. Do it, think about it, but please stay away from the Ouija boards and don't summon demons. It's not safe. And on that note, I hope that 2019 is fortuitous for you. And, you know, Ringo Dingo grants wishes.